Welcome to Art Bell Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001.
From the high desert in the great American Southwest, I bid you all good evening and or good morning, as the case may be, and welcome to the best nighttime talk radio in the world, stretching virtually across the world, from Guam in the west to the U.S. Virgin Islands in the east, south into South America, north, all the way to the pole and worldwide on the internet. This is Coast to Coast AM, and I'm Art Bell. Howdy. First of all, I would like to welcome yet another new affiliate. That would be KSUE in Susanville, California, 1240 on the dial there. So, hello, Susanville. Listen, Keith Roland, my esteemed webmaster, has come up with a really, I think, unique feature. Most radio programs will not list the affiliates that they're run on. And there's a reason they do that. They're usually afraid that other networks or radio shows will try and steal them away. Well, we list our affiliates, and boy, did Keith come up with a cool way of doing it. If you go to my website at www.artbell.com, and you go to the What's New thing on the left there, you'll see an updated affiliates list. But what a unique way of doing it. There's a picture of the United States, Hawaii, Alaska, Guam, and all the various states. And wherever you live, all you have to do is click on that state, and voila, all of the affiliates in your state, in your area, will be listed. That is pretty cool work, if I do say so myself. And I do. It's not mine, it's Keith's. Really cool stuff. So if you're looking for an affiliate in your area, that's the way to do it. Just go up there and click on your state. I see that he had to use extensions for all the Northeast states that are so close together. But it's really cool. You just click on whatever state you're in, take a look-see, and it'll tell you all the affiliates that are there. That is pretty cool stuff. So that's on the website right now at www.artbell.com. In the news tonight, let me see. Sharon defers talks after car bomb. Figures. New quakes hit India. That's pretty serious. A 5.3 magnitude injures 25. Doesn't kill anybody yet that we know of. Well, let's see. Congress reviews Bush tax plan. Argentina won't enter arms race. That's about as interesting as it gets. A couple of items. Somebody's, and I don't know how this got out. It's not real. It wasn't really a secret, but somehow it got out. Somebody sent me an email saying, someone told me Dan Aykroyd was going to be on the show. Is this true? He's not on the limited list on the website. Yes, it's true. Dan Aykroyd is going to be on. Dan Aykroyd had a very serious UFO sighting. A very, very serious UFO sighting. And so we're scheduling Dan Aykroyd for some time toward the end of the month. So it's true. I just don't know how it got out. All right, in a moment, we're going to do something a little different. I ran into somebody today who sent me a fax that I thought was really cool, interesting. It just said, time is not speeding up, creation is. And he goes on to say, we now have scientific proof from every discipline imaginable that the Mayan calendar is the timing of the unfolding of all creation slash evolution for the last 16.4 billion years. We now know the exact schedule, get this, the exact schedule of creation, including the future. We now can prove, as if it was needed, that more and more is happening in every second. It's the quickening with a different different angle here, a very different angle. Creation, my guest says, is speeding up. My guest is going to be Ian X.E.L. Lungold. And I really want to know what he's talking about. He's a layman. He's, however, done some work, scientific work in this area with some credentialed scientists. And so I'm very curious about what the man has to say. In a moment, we will find out. Here's somebody who wants to keep our current sounder. You know, the trash cans falling down the stairs. It's Larice who says, and why did 10-year-old Scarlett push her grandparents' metal trash cans down the wooden stairs? Because it sounds so cool, of course.
Now, we take you back to the night of February 8th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
This is Ian X.E.L. Lungold. Ian, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. Every now and then, I take somebody like yourself that just faxes me or emails me, and it sounded so intriguing that I had to ask. So I called you as soon as you faxed earlier today, and that's how you're on the program right now, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, time is not speeding up. Creation is. But first of all, you say creation slash evolution, so I guess we ought to get that straight. Do you have a preference, or could it be either or? Either or.
Yes.
So it doesn't really matter.
Creation is evolving.
Creation is evolving.
Consciousness is evolving.
Yeah, okay. I can get behind that. It could be either one, really, or both, actually. In other words, it could be what we call evolution. I suppose the whole thing could have started as the process of creation, and evolution is what we see unfolding scientifically.
Yes.
Huh, okay.
As a matter of fact, the Mayan calendar has 9 different levels described of consciousness or stages of evolution that are of various lengths of time. And this is how we can prove that creation is actually accelerating, is by measuring these levels.
Accelerating. So when you say creation, do you mean the actual changing of the human? In what ways are we changing?
Well, actually what we're talking about here is the entire universe from the Big Bang forward to today. So it's not just our evolution.
All right.
We are, to our own way of looking at it, we are the crown of evolution.
Yeah, that's our way of looking at it, and you're right, it's probably a little egotistical. It's really everything. We can know and touch and see and look, the stars, the planets, everything.
Yes.
Right, gotcha. All right, but you say it's speeding up.
Right. Well, actually, the Mayan calendar, like I said, is built on 9 different levels. The first level was 16.4 billion years or so long.
Boom.
The second level is some 820 million years long. Now, each of these levels turns out to be 20 times shorter than the level that came before it.
Uh-huh. Hence the speeding up.
Well, when we look at the historical record, we can see that the same amount of change happens in each one of these stages, but in 20 times less.
Faster time. and faster.
Faster.
Okay.
Yes. This is what you were describing as the quickening.
That I just called it that for lack of anything else. I could feel it. I could sense it. I knew it. And so I began to document it, and I wrote that book. You know, it's called The Quickening. But your explanation sounds quite logical to me thus far.
Actually, that's what I've found, too. I've been talking to a lot of people about this since I was introduced to the subject about a year and a half ago. And everyone that I've talked to has experienced an acceleration of events in their life, or breakthroughs, or developments in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
There is just no disagreement that more and more is happening in everybody's life, in every moment of everybody's life.
Well, you also say we now know the exact schedule of creation, which in itself is interesting, including the future.
Yes.
So somehow you're able to look at these faster and faster slots of time as we go forward from the present, and that's really interesting to me. What does our future look like, Ian?
Well, let's do a little bit of background first.
Sure, go ahead.
Because the future is predicated on what has already passed.
Mm-hmm.
We can predict the future in general by looking at the patterns of the past.
Mm-hmm.
This is actually what the Mayan civilization had going for it for its 5,000 years of existence. And now we're coming up on a time when we can once again view this information and apply it to our future as predictions. So let's take a look at the different cycles and what those cycles have produced.
Now, you did this by correlating two calendars, right? The Mayan
and the Gregorian? Yeah, the Mayan calendar is actually a calendar system. It's based on two different calendars. One is the Zolkin calendar.
Mm-hmm.
That is a 260-day periodicity. And every 260 days, it repeats the same pattern.
Okay.
And then there is another period of time called the Divine calendar or the Tune calendar, which is a 360-day periodicity. It's very interesting that the Maya had the most accurate solar calendar of any culture. Up until the advent of computers, they were the most accurate. But they never used that calendar for their civilization's ceremonies. They always used the 360-day calendar instead of the 365 and one-quarter day calendar.
Huh. I wonder why.
Well, because the 360-day calendar is measuring the actual happenstances of creation itself, not our lonely little orbit around this one dinky star.
Ah, you have a good point there. After all, creation is all that is, not the Earth's simple rotation around our little fairly dim star.
Right.
Good point. Okay.
And as it turns out, these cycles, each one of these nine cycles of creation or spans of consciousness are subdivided into 13 equal sections. And we can look at their both the effect and also the Mayan legends or their tradition of what these individual sections have as a purpose. And we find that actual events occurred that match the purpose of these 13 sections throughout all of the eight levels that we've so far passed through.
All right. And so then you took this calendar and somehow squared it with the Gregorian?
As a matter of fact, before I came into this last bit of information, I received a formula, and I say received because it was an idea that came all at once. An inspiration, I guess is another word to say,
mm-hmm.
that provided a formula which converts the Gregorian calendar to the actual Mayan calendar. And it was a very, very simple formula. It's so simple that anybody who is over the age of 8 can easily do it. And what people have been looking for 500 and some odd years, I came up with in about 30 seconds one afternoon.
You want to share it?
I can share it. In fact, I am sharing it as widely as possible from my website through a thing called the Mayan Calendar and Conversion Codex. And it's a very simple paper-folded product that in just a few moments can convert any Gregorian day to the Mayan calendar.
All right, so once you've done that, what have you achieved for us that is meaningful for us?
Well, what we can do, the whole output, the whole reason for paying attention to the Mayan calendar is because the Mayan calendar is measuring all of the natural cycles
Yes.
of all of creation.
Right.
And intuitively, inside, each of us knows that we need to get back to the natural rhythms of life.
That's for sure.
That our artificial systems are, in many ways, destroying us or imperiling us. And returning to a more natural way is something that's desired by almost everyone. So if you're putting your attention on something which is measuring all those natural cycles, then your consciousness is naturally tuned or entrained to those natural rhythms. And that's really the end goal of the whole Mayan calendar. It was never to keep track of time. It was always to be a measuring device or a tuning device for human consciousness or for consciousness of creation to know itself and its own path.
Okay.
It was always to draw people's consciousness back to the natural rhythms.
Now, was it the Mayan calendar that was supposed to just end?
It does.
It ends?
Yes.
Then, if it ends, how can you continue to project from it?
Well, you don't. actually, any game that you play has a beginning
and an end.
And an end.
Well, I somehow it's just unsatisfactory to have you say game over, because it's obviously not. I mean, here we are.
Well, there was a day when you graduated from high school. That was not the end of your life, but it was certainly the end of your high school days.
Right.
And we should look at the end of the Mayan calendar in a very similar way.
Okay, but again, you now say you cannot project from that which has ended, or can you? Because in here, in the facts you sent, you're saying, yes, you can. Creation is speeding up, and that we can virtually tell that what's going to happen in the future.
Up till a certain point, and then we're going to have conjecture after that, because once the Mayan calendar ends, pretty much as prediction ends. But we can extrapolate what happens after that. But what I think that we should go over a little bit about this Mayan calendar to show people what kinds of things have happened, how we came to understand how we can predict anything.
All right.
Okay?
Oh, yes.
Here we go. Now, each of these nine levels has 13 sections. It starts with inception, a beginning, the first section. It goes through a period of enlightenment, and then it goes through a period of application or adjustment. Then it goes through another period of enlightenment, then adjustment and enlightenment, and so on. There are actually seven periods of light and six periods of dark in each one of these nine sections. Each one of those periods has a specific purpose and a specific end or outcome. The seventh light, or the very end, the 13th section, is the fruit, if you want to call it that way, the fruit of the plant, or the end result of the plant, the expulsion of seeds for the procreation of another plant.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have here is that the very first section, after quite a long time, after 16.4 billion years, it produced the cell, the human cell.
Okay.
Or, excuse me, the first cell of life, 1.26 billion years ago, 1.25 billion years ago. Then the next cycle, called the mammalian cycle, was 820 million years long, and it was its product in the last part of it, was the first animal, some 850 million years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Then we come into the familiar cycle. Now, the familiar cycle was a consciousness that was earned or evolved to by the first anthropoids, the monkeys. We went from that into a 2-million-year-long cycle called the tribal cycle. And this is when the first humans appeared and formed tribes.
Mm-hmm.
After that was the cultural cycle. The cultural cycle has been running for 102,000 years. And this was actually in the seventh day of that, we got to where we were moved into the national cycle, which was when written language was invented, as well as the first nation, Egypt, and things like bronze were invented right during that period of time. That's a 5,125-year-long cycle.
Mm-hmm.
The planetary cycle, which we have just moved out of, was 256 years long. This was the period of industrialism, starting in 1775.
Certainly was, yes.
And we then moved into the galactic cycle, which started January 5th, 1999. And it will be running for 12.8 years.
Just 12.8 years?
Right. Now, the last cycle, the universal cycle, will last for 260 days.
That's not very long.
And that's the end of the calendar.
Is that the end of us?
No.
No.
That's not the end of consciousness.
Well, but I know, but what about the physical end of us?
It may be.
It may be the physical end of us?
Maybe. But what I want to point out here is that each one of these cycles contains the same amount of creation in 20 times less time. the same amount of creation it took for in 16.4 billion years when creation was moving very slow is going to happen now in these 12.8 years. Mm-hmm. And the same amount of creation, the same amount of change in all of our lives, the same amount of technology increase, the same amount of understanding that we will increase in this last 12.8 years will happen in the last 260 days as well.
Oh, brother, that's some cycle.
It's really tremendous.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back. He took 100 pounds of clay and made a really cute Raiders cheerleader. I'm Art Bell, and this is Coast to Coast AM in one of those cycles and moving pretty fast. Stay right where you are.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001.
I'm gonna fix this world today because I know what's missing. Then he rolled his big sleeves up and a brand new world began. He created a woman and a lot of loving for a man. Whoa, yes he did. With just 100 pounds of clay, he made my life worth living, and I will thank.
Changes because of that. Some people are going to exhibit another completely opposite effect in finding more of a piece of a natural order. And it depends on which way you're paying attention, which way your intention goes as to what kind of experience you're going to have. But in the fifth nights, there's always a disaster. And what we have coming up on us is a fifth night. And I wanted to kind of go through some of these past cycles to give people a perspective of what's coming up.
And so what might we expect in the fifth night?
Well, here in the mammalian cycle, we have the perm Triassic extinction of 97% of all life. In the human cycle, we have the Elonian Ice Age. In the cultural cycle, we have the extinction of the Neanderthals. In the national cycle, there was the collapse of Rome. In the planetary cycle was World War II and the development of atomic bombs.
Right.
Now, these were all in the fifth night. We have a fifth night that we're approaching. It will actually occur or start occurring on November 18th of 2007.
Oh, seven. Good. Thank you.
2007.
Mm-hmm.
And this fifth night will last for 360 days. Now, what we can expect in that is anything. If you think of creation as a semi-truck with a 9-speed gearbox, and the thing is loaded, maybe overloaded, it's absolutely dead still, you begin to take off in the first gear and you go very slowly, you wind up your acceleration until you reach the maximum speed in that gear, that would be the fifth day. That is the highlight of this cycle. Then what do? You put in the clutch.
Sure.
And what happens then is the momentum, the mass of that whole weight is rolling free. Anything can happen.
And it would be, at this point, just conjecture on your part to say what that anything would be.
In this case, anything in the 5 billion years ago was a meteor bombardment. The next was the pre-Triassic extinction period. So many things that...
Well, according to the kind of acceleration and change you're talking about, we're going to bump straight into a black hole or something.
Well, actually, what we're coming up on is an opportunity. If you look at all these past occurrences, you will see that they are getting to be less and less of a drastic effect.
Okay.
World War II, as bad as it was not the extinction of the Neanderthals or an ice age bombardment.
That's right.
Consciousness is actually learning to drive. We're not bumping into the walls as bad as we used to be. And what we have here is for the first time we know the schedule, we know what's coming up.
Gotcha.
And we have an opportunity to actually grasp the wheel and drive ourselves through this.
Can we change it?
We certainly can.
I mean, actually change it completely, take night and turn it into day?
Well, remember that a night is a period of application.
Yes, I understand.
And adaptation.
So you can't really change
it. If we do it consciously, we will have a much smoother transition. You see, World War II was a very definite intent. It was an intent, a focused intent to dominate the world.
Right.
Which is not necessarily a good one, but it was definitely a focused intent. The extinction of 90% of all life was not as focused of an intent. It was a general intent.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see that consciousness is becoming more and more conscious, more and more in control of its own destiny. And that's where we're coming up on. That's what's most important about getting this understanding and substantiating these facts for yourself, not just believing it, not just listening to a little blurb on the radio about it, but actually really getting in there and knowing these, recognizing this pattern. Because with that recognition, we as a race will be able to take huge step forward in our own consciousness.
All right, well, just take a little piece of what's going on right now. I discuss it a lot. The environment.
Yes.
Things are really rapidly, exponentially going downhill in so many ways with the environment at the moment. I could talk about a dozen different areas of melting ice and mammals that are beginning to eat each other and things that are changing and the ozone holes and the greenhouse effect and the warming climate and the I could go on and on and on and on. Where is this headed? When we get to the fifth day, does it get better or does it exponentially keep getting worse or what?
It really depends on where your attention is, but in general, what we're looking at is more and more is happening in every given moment. That means that more and more is possible in any given moment. What has always been the case is where you put your attention and intention is what you end up with.
Gotcha.
It's always your decisions that put you in the place you are.
Right, got you. So it depends on us. But,
it depends totally on us and on our understanding of our situation.
So you've really underlined the quickening in so many ways. It's just everything's getting faster. It could go either way. It could become better. It could become much worse. But whichever way it goes, it's going to get there faster.
That's right, and with more possibilities. You see, a miracle is something which is highly improbable.
Right.
As more and more and more happens in every given moment, what were once called miracles are more and more probable. Like, for instance, some Japanese scientists just recently accelerated particles past the speed of light. They actually received the particles before they were sent.
Right.
That's a miracle.
It's a miracle.
That's a miracle.
Right.
And we experienced it in our lifetimes. A microwave would have been a miracle to your grandmother.
Absolutely.
We're experiencing these things all around us. We see the miracles outside of ourselves easier than we see what's happening inside. But the fact is, unless our consciousness was keeping pace with these developments, we would not even see them, let alone be able to apply the technology.
Well, I'm really looking forward to telepathy. That's going to be very interesting.
And telekinesis.
And telekinesis?
All of the abilities that we have imagined.
The ability to, for those who don't know, affect material things with your mind.
That's right. All of those things which we have at one time supposed to be completely beyond possibility.
The paranormal.
But we recognize them. we are moving very rapidly toward that consciousness.
The paranormal will become the normal.
Yes. Now, in some cases, if people don't understand what is going on, they're going to think they're going nuts. And they will. But people who have a grasp of what this is and are actually participating in the flow will be able to benefit greatly from it.
Right.
That's the point.
Whoa, it's a very good one indeed. So people can learn more about this. You know, this has been a short interview, 1 hour, but I am grasping it. They can learn more at your website, right?
Yes.
www.mayanmagix.com, and we will have a link, I'm sure by now, up on the website.
And they can find there a means, a tool, to be able to start tuning their consciousness to the actual flow of all of creation. By putting your attention on the daily progression of the Mayan calendar, you are necessarily paying attention to the flow of all of creation. All of creation is the source of all knowing and intuition. The real crux of the matter is that your mind has a speed limit that is 33 frames per second, called the flicker frequency.
All right, well, we're rapidly running out of time here.
And the codex helps you to keep pace with creation. Let's just put it that way.
Does it worry you at all that the Mayan calendar ends?
No, because actually what happens is eventually everything, there's so much that is occurring in every moment that eventually everything happens at once, which is the case in the first place. And the illusion of time and space is thereby dissolved.
Yeah, people have always said that we have time so that everything doesn't happen at once.
And we're moving right to the crux of that matter.
Gotcha. All right. Pleasure having you on. I'm sure we'll do it again.
Thank you very much.
Take care, my friend. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Gary Schwartz up next.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8, 2001.
It could equal worldwide humiliation.
Presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired February 8th, 2001.
Somebody just sent me a real quick message on the fast glass and said, I saw an outside picture, which I sometimes, by the way, put up on the webcam during the day, and there was no pirate flag up. What happened? Well,
we've got 50-mile-an-hour winds. That's what happened, matey.
And when you get 50-mile-an-hour winds, it'll take any flag and rip it to shreds. And it's done that, too. So when the winds increase exponentially around here, as in quickening weather, we take the flag down so it may fly another day. Anyway, coming up in a moment is Dr. Schwartz, Dr. Gary E.R. Schwartz. I'll tell you all about him in just a moment.
Streamlink. The audio subscription service of Coast to Coast AM has a new name, Coast Insider. You'll still get all the same great features for the same low price, just 15 cents a day when you sign up for 1 year. The package includes podcasting, which offers the convenience of having shows downloaded automatically to your computer or MP3 player, and the iPhone app with live and on-demand programs. You'll also get our amazing download library of 3 full years of shows. Just think, As a new subscriber, over 1,000 shows will be available for you to collect, enjoy, and listen to at your leisure. Plus, you'll get streamed and on-demand broadcasts of Art Bell's Somewhere in Time shows and 2 weekly classics. And as a member, you'll have access to our monthly live chat sessions with George Norrie and special guests. If you're a fan of Coast, you won't want to be without Coast Insider. Visit coasttocoastam.com to sign up today. Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
It's obvious that the things that the Air Force has denied of the UFO phenomenon, there's a plan underfoot not to tell us anything. Why do you think that is?
Look, they've been lying to us, not just on UFOs. They lie about everything. Governments lie about everything. In other words, the moment of disclosure, that's not the end of anything. That is the beginning of an entirely new phase of the struggle for truth.
Now we take you back to the night of February 8th, 2001, on Art Bell's Somewhere in Time.
All right, comes now Dr. Gary E.R. Schwartz, Ph.D. Actually, just before he gets here, we've got a new feature on the website, which I think is really cool. Keith really did this one up just right. And if you want to know where an affiliate is in your area, he's got a map of the U.S. with each state. Click on your state. It will then list all of the affiliates in your state by city and call letters and frequencies and what have you. Really, really a cool piece of programming. But somebody just pointed out to me that Keith has not put on St. Thomas in the Virgin Islands. I'll have to check that out. He may have missed the Virgin Islands. I guess he got Guam, though. Gary E.R. Schwartz is a professor of psychology, medicine, neurology, psychiatry, and surgery. That's a lot. At the University of Arizona, director of the UA Human Energy Systems Laboratory, and director of the Bioenergy Corps at the UA Pediatric Alternative Medicine Research Center. He received his Ph.D. in clinical psychology from Harvard University in 1971, was an assistant professor at Harvard for 5 years. He was a professor of psychology and psychiatry at Yale University, director of the Yale Psychophysiology Center, and co-director of the Yale Behavioral Medicine Clinic. Before moving to Arizona back in 1988, he has published more than 300 scientific papers, including 6 papers in the journal Science, very prestigious, co-edited 11 academic books, and written The Living Energy Universe, and a lot more. But the Living Energy Universe is an interesting concept. From the subatomic to the cosmic, from cells and ideas to souls and God, all dynamic systems have memory. Using the tools of science, University of Arizona scientists Gary Schwartz and Linda Russick demonstrate that everything in the universe is alive, eternal, and evolving. That would include us, right? Their new model of life, the Universal Living Memory Theory, is reconfiguring the scientific landscape. Schwartz and Russick usher the reader through new doorways to profound discoveries. Here is stunning but sober emerging evidence that every idea, every thought, and every awareness ever generated is even now contained in the universe as information or memory, that consciousness survives death, that God exists and is evolving. Dr. Schwartz is no longer on the phone. We're going to have to get him back on the phone again, I see. So I guess I can do that. Let me do that. In fact, as I speak to you, watch, I can do this as I speak to you, I think. These things happen in live radio. And with any luck at all, we'll have Dr. Schwartz with us in a moment. In fact, let me do this. And Dr. Schwartz.
Hello.
Hi there, how are you?
Hi, this is Art.
It certainly is.
Hi, nice to speak with you.
Good to speak with you as well. I just read your whole bio and a little bit about the living energy universe, which I'm trying to grasp.
Okay.
So, let's see what we can do with this. This is quite a theory you have in this book. Explain it to me. That everything has memory, basically, is it, right?
That's correct. Now, there are two parts in order to explain this in simple language. The first is the realization that information, as well as energy, does not disappear when it goes out into space. And as we describe in the book, I tell this story of me sitting out in Vancouver. I don't know if you remember this, but where the light is coming off my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this realization, this was in the early 1980s when I was a professor at Yale, and I was reading this book about modern physics, and I was very confused about it. I was in Vancouver, British Columbia at the time, and anyway, it was 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'm sitting out pondering the nature of light, and the moon is shining, and I'm standing near to the window, and I can see thousands of houses to the light, to the right, that have lights on, and also thousands of houses to the left, because I'm way up on a penthouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that if I looked into those windows with a telescope, I could see what was happening in each of those.
Might not want to, but... You know,
right. Could. Now, that meant that each of the light from each of those windows was going to my window. But then I realized that if I could see them, they could see me.
Right.
That meant that my light was going into each and one of their windows. So the first thing I realize is, my God, my naked image is going into each of their windows. Not only was it going into each of their windows, but it was also going into the millions of windows that were not lit. And then I had this experience, which is part of the foundation for recognizing that, first of all, information doesn't die. And the realization I had was that not only was my light, and therefore everybody else's light, not just going into the windows, but what it was doing was going out into space. And that 1 second after I had that experience, my naked image was 186,000 miles into space.
Boy, imagine if that's the first thing that some alien approaching the planet would.
Right.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Yes, in fact, I tell the story that after I realized that I and everybody else was leaving an imprint of this information going out into space, and that once it was going out there, there was no way to get rid of it, I realized that we had some kind of responsibility for the kind of energy and information we leave behind, and I immediately decided to lose weight. I didn't think to put my clothing on, by the way. But, you know, humor aside, the whole basis of astrophysics is the idea that information and energy in the universe, when it gets out of the vacuum of space, it continues and doesn't really lose, you know, much of any of its integrity. That's why you can have satellites that can be put up telescopes can put up in satellites where they can look back to purportedly to photons that have been around for 12 billion years.
Well, that's true, but that's in the vacuum of space. Here on Earth, we have to contend with atmosphere that diffuses light.
Right, it diffuses light. But the point that I'm trying to make is that in the vacuum of space, energy and information does not by itself degrade or disappear. So that's the first point. And then we'll get to what happens if the light is in fact contained or modified along the way, which is how it gets to the idea that this is not just dead information, but it is actually living information. And that's the second part of the analysis. But the first part we have to understand is that information and energy does not just simply, quote, disappear. It may be revised along the way, but it does not end. Otherwise, we couldn't have a science of astrophysics. So that's fact one. Now, the second part, which is what makes the work exciting, is you take that idea and you combine it with the logic of how feedback works. Now, what's feedback? We take a microphone, for example, and plug it into an amplifier with a speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And then we point the microphone toward the speaker, and what happens?
Well...
Hey, you did that.
Well, I'm fast.
You're very fast. I'm impressed.
That's feedback for you.
You know, it's funny. I've told this story a number of times on radio and television, but no one demonstrated it. Literally, by the time the words got out of my mouth. This is a first. By the way, welcome back to your show.
Oh, thank you.
So, now, the question is, where did that sound come from? Okay? We don't typically think about this, but where did that sound come from? Now, this was the early 1980s, and I was teaching a new course at Yale.
Well, it's a loop, right?
Feedback is a loop.
Yeah.
But the question is, how do you go from no sound to sound? And I wanted to give the students a feeling for how this worked. Okay? Now, I have to explain that Einstein was a hero of mine. And do you know how it was that he actually originally stumbled upon the theory of general relativity?
Sorry, I'm having a little trouble with my right ear right now. How he stumbled upon the theory of relativity.
Here's how it happened. He was actually a child. And what he did was, he had a very vivid imagination, and he took a ride with a light beam. He imagined himself being a photon, being a light beam, and he's now traveling in space at the speed of light. And then what he did was he looked out at what he saw, and what he saw was not what he expected to see. He was surprised. And years later, when he became a physicist and learned the mathematics, he transformed that initial experience into the mathematics that led to general relativity. Well, I said, I'm a child. I'm going to try to do even though I was an adult, obviously.
Well, wait. If he was going at the speed of light, traveling along at the speed of light and looked out, what did he see that surprised him?
What he saw was he realized that traveling at the speed of light, for him, time slowed down. Because for him, he couldn't imagine anything traveling faster than the speed of light.
That's right. Time would slow down.
Exactly. In fact,
okay.
Stan stood still. And he had this as an experience because he realized that he couldn't see. He couldn't see any faster than light itself traveled. So therefore, he'd be traveling at the speed of light, but he wouldn't even know it. Now, this is a kid, remember, who has his experience. And what he saw was not what he expected to see. Well, here's what I decided to do. I was going to make believe I was Einstein. I mean, it's early 1980s. I was maybe 35 years old at the time. And so what I decided to do is I was going to make believe I was an electron. And I was going to travel around in a feedback loop. So I was going to connect two components in a what's called a resonating circuit. So A is an electronic component with a wire that's attached to B, and then B vibrates and sends this information back to A, okay, and then it goes around and around. And what I did was I hitched a ride with the electron. And as the electron went around this circuit, what I did was I wrote down what I saw. So I took the ride once, okay? And when I got around, what I saw was not what I expected to see. I took the ride a second time, and then I became, to tell you the truth, terrified.
What did you see?
What I saw was that as I was an electron and I took this ride, here's what was happening. And it's very simple to take you through the ride, and your reader should, the listener should take the ride with me. We're going to go from A to B. Now, by the way, we can do that even talking back and forth with you and me over the airways. Okay?
Right.
I'm A and you're B, and
right.
So on and so forth. Here's what happens. I speak, for example. Now, the electrons pick up this information, and they travel to you. And the important thing to realize is that it takes time for something to travel from A to B. It's a finite period of time, okay? Even if it's fast, it takes time. So at this time, too, what's happened is that what you're receiving is a history of what I sent you. And by the way, if that information was not preserved, you would not be able to tell what I was saying.
Mm-hmm.
You can't have communication without the information being preserved.
Correct.
Right?
Yes, of course.
So at time, too, what you're actually getting is the history of what I said at time one.
Right.
Now, this hits you, and now what do? You process this information, and that takes time.
Right.
It's time for you to hear this, and then you're going to do something with that information. And the simplest thing that you could do is to repeat it and send it back to me. So if I say, hello, you would then say, hello.
Yo.
Yo, right. Actually, it was very good that you said yo. Now, here's why. Because what comes out of you at time three, this was the deep insight, what comes out of you at time three is actually some combination of what I sent to you at time one plus the state that you were in at time two.
Mm-hmm.
So at time three, what's coming out is A1, B2. That's a simple way to describe it.
That was my yo.
That was your yo, right. Now your yo is going to come back to me. It also takes time. So at time four, here's the key point. What am I responding to? What I'm responding to is A1, B2. In other words, what I'm responding to is a history of myself as perceived and revised by you. So what comes out of me at time five is actually, at time five, is actually what we call A1, B2, A4. It's actually some combination of the state that I was in at time four, influenced by the state that I had been at time one, as modified by you. Now, I'm going to send that back to you. So here's the critical thing. As long as you and I are connected in this feedback process, and this information does not completely degrade, what's going to happen? You're going to get an accumulation of information in this loop that is going to be continually revised through the process. So what's actually stored in the system is the relationship between you and me. You got it?
Yeah, I think so. This is tougher than the Mayan calendar thing I just went through, but yes, I think I'm getting
it. But it's, and here's the simple way to explain this. Let's get back to this, the sound with the microphone. Okay, let's put it back in plain English.
I can't do that again. My ear can't handle it.
No. Don't demonstrate it. But when you point the microphone, here's what happens. Initially, the speaker is making like a tiny little hum, or there's a little bit of sound in the air. The microphone picks it up and sends it to the speaker. What the speaker does is it amplifies it just a tiny bit. The amplified sound is then sent back out and sent to the microphone. The microphone picks up the amplified sound, sends it back to the speaker, which amplifies it again, sending it back to the speaker. It goes over and over and over.
Over and over. It can be even more graphically demonstrated by taking a video camera and pointing it at the monitor that's running it. And you'll see a million video cameras down to infinity.
Exactly. In fact, we call that video systemic memory.
There you are.
And we have that on our website, www.livingenergyuniverse.com.
We do have a link up there for that.
Good. So the answer is exactly when you connect the feedback loop. But you see, here's what we don't typically realize, that it takes time for that sound to grow. And the growth process can be recognized if we slow the process down. So, by the way, with your video cameras, if any of your listeners have this, if they have any of the new digital cameras, they can actually play them in slow motion, record in slow motion. And now what you can do is you can have a frame go by once per second, and you can actually see the creation of that systemic memory.
I understand. In other words, you see
the accumulation,
the cameras cascading down the line.
Right. Now, that's if you have it set at the wide angle. If what you do is you actually set it so the lens is slightly bigger, you'll see it cascading in an increased way. And then if you start putting your hand and other things between the camera and the monitor, magic happens. Because you start accumulating complex information. That's how a feedback loop works. And what I realized quite unexpectedly was that that logic applied to every feedback loop, regardless of the level in nature. That's why we came to the conclusion that everything in the universe remembered.
All right, I know I want to talk about that. Stay right there. We're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Actually, under the bright conditions, particularly out here where I live, you can see for miles.
I know you can see me now. Here's a surprise.
Look, 1,000 knees.
That you have, cause there's magic in
life. Yeah, I'll see if I can lose weight.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001.
If you think that I don't know about the little tricks you play, I never see you when deliberately you're working my way. Well, here's a cold that you, you're gonna choke on it too. You're gonna lose that smile, because of the wild. I can see for miles and miles. I can see for miles.
I can't follow the life of me. Never.
Listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001.
You know, I always thought this song had some profound meaning, but I've been told by some who claim to know that it was nothing more than a breakfast the author of this song was eating, chicken and eggs, and he was just about to mix the chicken with the eggs, mother and child reunion.
Now we take you back to the night of February 8th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Doctor, welcome back.
Hi.
Hi. All right. Well, I think I certainly understand the concept of feedback, and as you have demonstrated it here, where are we going with this in terms of...
Okay. This is how we can summarize it, and then we can have fun. Because once you've gone through the basic logic, it leads us to virtually every anomaly that's been reported in parapsychology and paraphysics, which is one of the most interesting implications of the theory.
Okay, stay good and close to your phone for me.
Okay. Here is the number one idea. Feedback loops, as we said, apply to all systems.
Mm-hmm.
And a system contains A and B. So A could be an electron and B could be a proton in an atom. And therefore, we'll have feedback loops and hence what we call systemic memory or learning in atoms. A could be hydrogen and B could be oxygen making a water molecule. Therefore, water molecules can learn, which of course would explain homeopathy. Just like Adam's learning would explain what's called psychometry in parapsychology, reading watches, for example.
Mm-hmm.
A could be one strand of DNA, and B could be another strand of DNA, and therefore DNA itself could be learning. A could be one neuron, and B could be another neuron, two neurons, which would provide you with a neural feedback network, which is how the brain learns. But A could also be one heart cell, and B could be another heart cell. And therefore, hearts could learn, which made predictions about organ transplants and personality changes. A could be the heart itself, and B could be the brain, so you could have learning within the whole body. A could be one person, and B could be another person.
Yeah, there's evidence of that. I think we talked about that, the lady who had the transplant.
Exactly. Well, there's actually evidence for all of this. But just to finish the logic, A could be the Earth, and B could be the sun. Or A could be
sure.
One galaxy and B could be another galaxy.
Gotcha.
It doesn't matter.
Right.
Whatever level in nature, to the extent that they are engaged in a circulating feedback process, there would be some kind of a storage of information and energy as the system unfolded. And therefore, everything would be learning that had a feedback loop. That was the big, big implication. Now, just for the record, when this idea originally occurred to me in the early 1980s, I had three fundamental fears. Fear number one was I didn't know if the logic was correct, and so I would have to write a paper. But when I wrote a paper explaining the logic and people saw some of the implications, some of my colleagues at Yale would think that I had lost it because I was now going to be sounding like a flake, you know, from homeopathy to survival of consciousness after death and more were all predicted by the theory. The second fear was that the theory might be wrong. Now, in science, you know, we've been historically wrong. You know, we used to think the Earth was flat. We used to think the sun revolved around
That's right.
the Earth. I mean, you know,
That's right.
we ideas in science are always changing. And, you know, I love that fact. That's part of the fun of being a scientist. However, because this was such a big theory, it was a big mistake to make, right? A huge mistake. But here was the worst fear of all, the third fear. And that is, what if the theory was actually correct? Well, if the theory was correct, I was going to have to change virtually everything that I believed in. So I did what any sane scientist would do. I didn't tell a soul. And I kept the theory secret for 13 years until I met Linda Russick, who ultimately became the co-author of the book and my spouse and co-conspirator in doing research and writing in this area.
And so you told her?
So I told her. Now, why did I tell her? Here's the reason why. I meet this woman in 1993 at a scientific meeting, a conservative scientific meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And actually at this meeting, and this is important to know, is that her father had been a distinguished cardiologist, and he had recently died. And they were honoring her father with an endowed named lecture. And Linda and I started talking, and we shared very deep secrets with each other, and I wanted to meet her again. So I flew out a couple of weeks later from Tucson, Arizona, to Boca Raton, Florida, where she was living.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just coming in for an evening because I was flying to New York to family celebration and then flying back to Boca so I could then go back to Tucson. Well, anyway, so we're talking and talking, and 4 o'clock in the morning, she's driving me to a Florida airport for me to catch an early flight back so I can be in Tucson on Monday afternoon to give a lecture. And she asked me a question that no one had ever asked me before. She said, Gary, she says, do you think it's possible that my father is still alive? Do you believe in the possibility of survival of consciousness after death?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, essentially, excuse me. You have to understand, no one had ever asked me this question before. She said, really? And I said, well, would it matter to you what I think? And she said, yes. And I said, well, why? Why would it matter to you what I think? And she said, well, because you're a serious scientist. You have a reason to think that it's possible. You probably have a good reason. So I said, well, to tell you the truth, many years ago when I'd been at Yale, I had stumbled upon this theory called systemic memory. And I said, although I hadn't told the logic to anyone, so I didn't know then if it was correct. And, of course, I had never done any research in the area, so I didn't know really it was true. I said, but to tell you the truth, everything I know about physics and chemistry and biology and psychology and so on would lead me to think the theory was plausible. So she says, well, what's the theory? Well, you have to remember, it's 4 o'clock in the morning. I'm exhausted. So I said, Linda, look, tell you what. I'll come back and visit you in another couple of weeks. And in the light of day, I'll tell you the whole theory from the very beginning, and then you can come to your own conclusion. So I flew back, and I tell her the theory. We take a long walk. Now, obviously, Linda's biased. She's had a father that she dearly loved. She's looking for a scientific reason to believe that he's still here. And so she's going to obviously be predisposed to think that this is possible. On the other hand, she was also her father's daughter. I mean, Linda's father had published over 200 scientific papers, edited 7 books in the field of cardiology. I mean, they had done research together. So she was, you know, trained to be skeptical like I was. So she searched for a flaw in the logic, and she couldn't find one.
Well, I might have one.
Good. Well, you'll give it to me in a second. Let me just finish the
story. Okay, go ahead.
So she says, Gary, she says, do you realize how important this is? And I said, well, I realize some of the implications, but I'm really quite frightened of them. She said, Gary, she says, you've got to help me. We've got to test your theory and see if we can prove whether my father is still here. Now, you've got to put yourself in my shoes. You know, you're an established academic.
Sure.
Who's just been asked by a very special person to do research in an area that you know some of your colleagues are going to be very upset with. In fact, now that our work has become fairly public, it's been on HBO and Arts and Entertainment and Dateline and so on and so forth, the way we like to put this is that some of my colleagues would prefer that we'd be doing this research somewhere else.
Sure. So on the one hand, you're thinking Yale, Harvard, my career,
right.
Everything that I've been so far. On the other hand, you're thinking great-looking woman. And my theory. What do I do here?
Right, exactly. I said, okay. My colleagues would rather be happy to be on another planet.
Yeah.
Here's how we write it in the book, and this is very important. What had happened to me was that I had fallen in love with Linda's love for her father. I'm going to repeat this. I had fallen in love with Linda's love for her father and her dream to know scientifically one way or another if he was still here. So I looked into her eyes and I said, okay, Linda, I'll help you, but only under one circumstance. We don't tell anyone. And actually, the way this work began was for the first couple of years, we began our research secretly, quietly, in Boca Raton, Florida. And when the results continued to be positive, Linda moved to Tucson, and the rest, as they say, is history.
What's
the flaw?
I'll get to that in a second now. What kind of results were you getting?
Well, we were starting to do research I mean, this was what Linda wanted to do. She wanted to know whether there was a way, as we said, to prove whether her father was still here.
Mm-hmm.
And since we were using this kind of systemic memory resonance kind of model,
mm-hmm.
and since Linda had posited that it was possible that his energy might not only be weak, obviously, because it was he was no longer in a physical body,
right?
You know, like the light from distant stars,
right?
But also, he might be in frequencies that we're not consciously aware of,
right? Again.
So one of the things that she did was she was interested in seeing whether or not the frequencies were in sound waves, but sound waves that were either below or above, particularly above areas of human hearing.
Right.
So she purchased microphones that went down to 5 hertz. You know, the ear only hears about 20.
That's right.
And it went up to 100,000 hertz, and the ear typically hears 20,000.
The best ears do.
Yes. And this was put into what was called a Hewlett-Packard spectrum analyzer that did these kinds of analyses for the whole spectrum in real time. So we were able to actually look and see what these microphones were picking up. And then what Linda did was she would attempt to, for example, look at her father's picture and invite her father to try to communicate with her.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did was we recorded the sounds. Okay. We also recorded brain waves and electrocardiograms and so on.
Sure.
But we were interested to see whether or not that there was anything might be picked up. Now, I must tell you that, to tell you the truth, in those days, I thought all of this was crazy. I mean, I thought it was just, you know, a little nuts. But the problem was it was consistent with the theory, and so we started trying it. And what happened was, just to make the long story short, is we began to see anomalous phenomena occurring that suggested that there was some sort of energetic pattern that would be coming in that we could not explain under normal circumstances.
Any particular frequency range?
Well, we were seeing it actually in the very highest frequencies. I mean, literally up in the 90 to 100 thousand hertz range. However, I tilted all that data, and we did many experiments. Because remember, we were doing this on the side. We had our regular careers, and we were doing it, so this was on the side. But all these early studies did, was suggested that something might be possible. And it wasn't really until we began our mediumship research that we began to get the kinds of, you know, jaw-dropping findings that turned out.
All right, we'll get to those. Let me try what I thought might have been a flaw.
Good.
You talked about systemic memory.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the big question for all humans is whether what we understand to be consciousness continues or whether we're sort of an echo of ourselves forever spreading out into time as light would.
Right.
In other words, so are we, sure, I believe the energy continues, but does it continue in a form that we would call consciousness? That's a big question.
Big question. In fact, when Linda and I, in 1993, when I took this walk with Linda, which was actually on the beach, and I told her this theory, her number one question to me was my father's energy, quote, dead?
Yes.
Just an echo?
Right.
Or was it actually as living and as conscious?
Precisely.
As he was?
Precisely.
And here's what the theory predicted. What the theory predicted and predicts is that in the same way that our energy and information is contained within a structure which has cells and boundaries, okay, which is what defines our body.
Right.
And the reason that we have energy and information, that we don't just all diffuse into space, is because we also have a locality which is based on the boundary conditions and ways of maintaining this system. What the theory predicted was that the history of our boundary conditions also was retained. In other words,
meaning
that literally the cellular membranes and literally the even the skin that we have, all of that energy and information is as preserved as everything else. So that which enabled us to have integrity and circulate as an internal feedback loop to begin with, does not disappear. That's why, by the way, you could see my naked image in space, because it in fact maintained not just its static form, but all the structural components of what made it a form to begin with.
But you haven't explained to me, I don't think you have yet, how consciousness, as we understand it...
Right. So now the really, really big question...
Yeah, that's the big one.
...is where does consciousness come from to begin with? Now, here's what I'm saying, what Linda said. What Linda said was, is that the explanation of the origin of consciousness itself is, you know, one of the two truly great mysteries. And we can talk about this for hours. But what the feedback loop does is that the feedback loop allows a system to be conscious of itself. Because remember, what A is doing is receiving a history of itself as perceived and revised by B. That's what A is doing in the system. So therefore, I become conscious of myself in part by sending my energy out and then having it come back reflected to me. That's what's called self-consciousness.
Okay.
So I become aware of myself because there is a feedback loop. Feedback creates self-awareness. And what we said is as long as the feedback loops remain intact, self-awareness remains intact. You got it?
Yes, I think I do. Wouldn't this be the way ultimately a machine or a computer would become self-aware?
Yes. In fact, what feedback theory predicts is that everything has self-awareness, from the tiniest to the most gigantic, and that everything has some kind of self-awareness process, but depending upon the complexity of the system, obviously, what it is conscious of is going to be different. But it's all going to have consciousness. That's why the theory is so broad, because it says everything is eternal, alive, and evolving, which also means what? Everything has self-awareness.
Now, let me understand the physical aspects of the experiment you did with her.
Mm-hmm.
You were monitoring specifically what? In what way? You were monitoring high frequencies, but you from sensors attached to or sensing what?
Well, what we did was we had microphones.
Okay.
And in the case of the sound experiments, we
had microphones.
One microphone, for example, would be pointed at the space between Linda and her father's picture.
Okay.
And another microphone, the control microphone, would be pointed, let's say, away from the two of them. So you've got an active microphone picking up information.
Gotcha.
Between Linda and her father's picture.
Right.
And then you've got a control microphone that's just picking up, quote, background noise.
Uh-huh.
And then what would happen is that Linda would invite her father to make his presence known. Now, of course, what did this require? This required the plausibility that her father was still there, and that he could function, and we describe this in our scientific papers, as a, quote, departed hypothesized co-investigator. You know, that's scientific jargon for saying,
yes.
Yeah, right, that her dead father is working with us.
How, though, were you able to discern the fact that the energy that you were hearing wasn't coming from Linda?
The answer was, of course, we couldn't. This experiment did not enable us to disentangle what Linda was bringing to the situation.
Right.
From what her potentially father was bringing
right.
as well.
Right.
Exactly. And that's why we said we must do these kinds of experiments where the person is no longer in the loop. So, and we have to design equipment, for example, where microphones are placed in separate rooms and where the a given person could, let's say her father could be invited to be in room A at one time and room B in another time, and then you look to see whether you've got the alterations in sound depending upon where the, quote, spirit was present. But what I need to share is that, you know, I considered this to be so controversial that I told Linda that I didn't see how we could do research in this area. Remember, this is 1993, 1994, we're doing these early studies. I said, we have to be able to do something that is much more informative about the reality of all this to begin with before I would feel comfortable about it ever talking about any of this in public.
Well, actually, if you never had proven in any way that it was Linda's father, you still would beyond something very serious from a scientific point of view.
Oh, absolutely. But I mean, and you know, we've done research now in water, and we've done research with cardiac transplant patients and so on and so forth. But since I was so nervous about all of this, you know, I didn't really want to address any of it. And it was Linda's pushing me that said, come on, Gary, this is too important to ignore. And so when people ask me, you know, why I started doing this work, I say, well, I was pushed there by science, but I was pulled there by love.
Well, that I understand. All right, Dr. Schwartz, hold on. Stay right there. We've reached a pretty interesting point here. Now, if he had never gone any further and had never proven that it was a separate entity, as I just mentioned to him, he'd still be onto something really big. Because what was the human mind doing that would produce spikes in a microphone, actual high-frequency spikes, much higher than we're able to hear, that you could record when thinking about such things? That alone would be a big scientific discovery. But if, in fact, it's actually led to the discovery of life on the other side, well, that's much bigger.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8, 2001. Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8, 2001.
Yes, indeed. If you're teaching at Harvard and Yale, and you have colleagues that are probably shaking their heads at you, you've got a lot to lose, potentially, in this kind of investigation. But on the other hand, what question can any of you out there think of that's more important than whether we continue? Whether our consciousness continues. I really can't think of any more important questions, so we will press the good doctor when we come back from the break, and we'll find out how he was able to actually discern that there is a consciousness that continues. It's an incredible field to follow, and follow it we shall.
Now we take you back to the night of February 8th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Back now to Dr. Gary E.R. Schwartz, and we're talking about whether consciousness actually survives physical death. That really is what it's all about. And the early experiments with his wife, Linda, showing promise, but not conclusive by any means with respect to whether you were actually seeing another consciousness or an extension of Linda's mind. Something I think we know through lots of disciplines like remote viewing and other things that people seem to be able to do with their living minds. Doctor?
Right. Exactly. Here's how our work with mediums began, and what initially appointed us in the direction of saying, wow, there may be a real phenomena here, and that we can bring it into the laboratory and actually provide definitive data one way or another that the phenomena that, you know, Linda's father's here, and therefore potentially all of our fathers and mothers and so on are potentially with us. Here's what happened. In 1997, I was in California, and I was giving an invited address at the California Biofeedback Society, which is not important, but I was there, and I was in the same city where a woman who I had learned about, a housewife from Irvine, California, her name is Lori Campbell, who, by the way, now has her own website. It's LoriCampbell.net, www.LoriCampbell.net. She's a very phenomenal medium. I, of course, had never met a medium before.
Mm-hmm.
But I was told that I should meet this woman because she was interested in science. Now, by the way, you know, most mediums are not interested in science. They're, you know, they're helping grieving people, or they're being famous, or they're being frauds. But they're typically not interested in science. So I went to meet this woman, and I went to be as an observer. And I go to meet this woman, and she's going to read somebody else. And I walk in, and the first thing she says to me, she says, your mother's here. I said, I don't see my mother. And she says, well, you know, I can see your mother. She's deceased, right? And I said, yes. And then she goes on to describe my mother. And she describes my mother to a T. Her size, her weight, her personality. And my mother is now giving me messages that I need to call my brother because she's concerned about his welfare, which turned out to be true, so on and so forth. And I said, well, thank you very much, Lori, but I'm really here to observe you as a scientist, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So she is now interacting with this other person, and I'm watching how she works. And then she comes back, and she says, your father's here. And I said, excuse me. And then she goes on to describe my father, who's standing behind my mother, and he's also short, he's a small man, and he's very quiet, so on and so forth. And she describes my father to a T. So now I start getting interested. And I said, Lori, I said, can I ask you a question? She said, yes. I said, can you give me any information about a man named Henry? Now, Henry was Linda's father's name. And, you know, purportedly, we have been doing research with Henry, right?
Yes.
But Lori Campbell didn't know anything about Henry. She didn't know my wife or
right,
anything like this.
Right, right.
Well, all of a sudden, her voice changes, and she almost like she has tears in her eyes, and she just comes overflowing with love, totally different from my mother and father in terms of character. She says, this man is telling me that he's been waiting to speak to us for years, and he's been following our research, and he really loves his daughter, and he and so on and so forth. And all of a sudden, I'm now witnessing a third personality, which is potentially like the father-in-law I never met.
Doctor, what did this woman know about you before you met?
Well, yeah, I'm going to get to this, because I had no idea. You know, my immediate hypothesis was she got information ahead of time.
Obviously.
Right. She went to the web. You know, she has a detective. You know, I asked all these things. And you're going to see why all of this gets discounted in a minute. I then say, okay, this is very interesting. I say, well, let me ask you one other question, Lori. I said, can you tell me anything about a person by the name of William James? Now, William James is a very distinguished deceased scientist who has been purportedly in communication with a woman named Susie Smith,
mm-hmm.
who has just finished her 30th book called The Afterlife Codes and has a website called www.iafterlifecodes.com. And Susie has been purportedly in communication with this dead scientist for 40-some-odd years. And, you know, I couldn't believe any of this. So I said, so Lori asked me, who's William James? You have to remember, Lori is a housewife from Irvine, California, uneducated.
Right.
She doesn't know any Harvard professors. So I said, well, he's a friend of a friend. Okay. Well, all of a sudden, it was the first time I've ever witnessed what people sometimes call trance mediumship. Lori was literally, quote, taken over. She describes being at the turn of the century. She's surrounded by all these books. Everything's mostly in black and white. She's wearing old clothing, and she starts lecturing about the importance of the psychology of consciousness and consciousness surviving death, and it's so important that research in this area is going on and so on. And by now, you have to understand, now I'm
sure.
Really bothered.
Of course.
So here's what happens, and this is the take-home message. I call Linda. I had to catch a plane to get back to Tucson. Linda was not with me. I said, Linda, I've just met this remarkable woman. And I said, I don't know what to make of this. I'm going to put her on the phone. She doesn't know anything about you or your father. Not that I've told her. And I said, you talk to Lori, be very cautious, and come to your own conclusion. So I hand the phone to Lori. And Lori says to Linda, she says, Lori, she says, hi, and she says, my name's Lori. She says, I want you to know your father's here, and your father wants me to tell you to thank you for the music. Just those five words, thank you for the music. Now I hear the words, thank you for the music. What does that mean? It doesn't mean anything to me. Meanwhile, on the other end of the phone in Tucson, Linda is in tears. Why? Because when her father was dying, he was in an intensive care unit, and he was on a ventilator. And the doctors thought that he was unconscious in a coma. But Linda was convinced that he was somehow still aware. So what she did was she brought in a tape recorder and pillow speaker.
Oh, boy.
And played special music for her father. The only people who knew about that music was her mother, her sisters, a couple of nurses, and a couple of doctors.
That's a jolt.
That was an absolute jolt. Let me tell you something. We have done now 3 years of research with Lori Campbell. We have witnessed her do over 100 readings. There's only one time that Lori ever said to any sitter that we know of, your father is saying thank you for the music. In other words, this is not just a line that she gives everybody.
No, I'm with you. I'm with
you. She throws out.
Right, I'm with you.
So it was at that moment that Linda and I said, wait a second. This woman may be doing something that's extraordinary. And if she's willing to come into a laboratory, maybe we can design experiments to actually prove whether or not Lori is getting information from a living conscious entity.
Well, you're already pretty far along that trail.
Absolutely. But not in terms of what a scientist
is. I understand, yes.
Yeah, you understand that.
Sure.
But we were already, quote, left with, you know, data that cannot be disputed, at least not be disputed fairly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it started. Now, I'd be very happy to share with you some of the wonderful and playful experiments that we've done.
Sure. By all means, please do.
Okay, well, let me share with you one that I think is absolutely delightful.
What I don't get is how you move from this very strong evidence that you have
mm-hmm.
to scientific evidence, how you move it into the field of science.
Well, that's what I'm going to show you.
Okay.
Okay. Here's one of the first experiments that we did. We've done many now, okay? And this one is one of the more creative. We have two mediums. Medium 1 and Medium 2, okay? And Medium 1 has never met Medium 2 and vice versa, okay? And we know this from their phone records and so on. And Medium 1 is actually Susie Smith, who has been in a wheelchair for years, and she was at that time, I think, 86 years old. Susie Smith claims that she's in communication with her deceased mother, whose name is Betty, with Professor William James from Harvard University,
mm-hmm.
with Dr. Henry I. Russick, Linda's father, which we, of course, could never confirm alone before with this research, and also purportedly with my father, Howard Schwartz.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Lori Campbell had already claimed that she received information from my mother, my father, Linda's father, and William James.
Right.
The question was, how could we prove that they were actually, that Lori was actually communicating with these people?
That's right.
So here's the experiment that came to us. It turned out that Medium One, which was with Susie, is a very good artist. So we proposed the following experiment. Susie would, first of all, in the privacy of her home in Tucson, invite these four people to serve as part of hypothesized co-investigators. And by the way, obviously we have to take Susie's word for this. So she proposally does it and says, yes, everybody wants to collaborate. Okay. Step two, in the privacy of her own home, what Susie does is she invites each of these four people to suggest a picture that Susie is going to draw for them. So each of these people asks Susie to draw a picture, because remember, Susie's a medium.
Mm-hmm.
So Susie draws these pictures, okay? One for each departed hypothesis going there.
Right.
Of course, we do not know what they are. We're totally blind to this, right? Because Susie does this by herself. In addition, Susie draws a control picture. She draws a picture for herself.
Okay.
And this is a control for telepathy or remote viewing. And it's to what extent can Lori get information about her picture?
Right.
Okay? So she's got these five pictures. They're put into an envelope, dated and sealed. Okay? Then, that's part one of the experiment.
Sure.
Part two, Lori Campbell is flown to Tucson. And in a separate building, she has not yet met Susie. Lori was medium two. In two-hour sessions, she is asked to contact each of the four departed hypothesized co-investigators, each of the four dead people. And her task is to attempt to to see and describe each of their respective pictures. Because the task of the dead people is to try to show them or tell her what their pictures are. Linda calls it from here to there and back again experiment.
Okay.
Here, Susan, you know, medium one, there to the dead people and back again.
Gotcha.
To medium two, okay?
Right.
Now, in addition, Lori's task is to guess what the control picture is. Can she go to Susie's apartment in her mind, where she's never been, and see if she can get Susie's picture?
Mm-hmm.
So she does two-hour sessions. It's all videotaped. And what we do, because, you know, Lori doesn't remember most of this. She's sort of more or less in a trance. What we do is we keep a record of the color and form information that Lori describes for the pictures, okay? So now we've got all this information. And, of course, Linda and I have no idea whether Lori's gotten anything correct.
Right.
Because we've never seen the pictures. Now, part three. Medium one and medium two meet for the first time. And this is all, of course, videotaped. And then there are three experiments. There's Linda's and myself, and also Dr. Donald Watson, who's a psychiatrist, who is the person that introduced us to Lori Campbell. And here's what happens. First of all, what Lori Campbell attempts to do, and also what we attempt to do, is based on our, what Susie does is she opens the pictures in front of the cameras. So for the first time, we now see the five pictures.
Right.
But we don't know which picture is associated with which person.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So we're kept blind to that.
Sure.
But we see the pictures. Now, our task, first of all, is to see whether we can guess, just by our own intuitions and our own knowledge of the people, which picture we think was drawn by each person. And by the way, the probability of guessing this by chance is going to be 1 in 5 or 20%.
Sure.
Right? Okay. Then part two, what we did, is that each of us independently used the color and form information provided by Lori during her mediumship sessions to see if we could guess which picture
mm-hmm.
was drawn by which person.
Right.
Here was the data. And then I'll give you the details about why it supports the survival of consciousness hypothesis. When we were trying to guess based on our own, quote, intuitions and hunches.
You were the control group, right?
Well, we were the control group, but
sure.
When all four of us were actually control when we were just using our guesses.
Right.
Okay, as opposed to using what Lori had received during the mediumship.
Right.
So during these, quote, control guesses, our average estimate accuracy of guessing the pictures was 20%. I got 20%, I think Don Watson got 20%, somebody else got 40%, and I think Linda got 0% or something mm-hmm. like that. It averaged out to 40%. We have the numbers reported in the paper. However, when we used the color and form information that had been obtained when Lori, medium two, was connecting with the deceased people, each of us independently got 100% accuracy.
Oh, my.
100% perfect. Now, this was disturbing. Let me tell you why. This is now where you get to the details, where the data are so fascinating. Let's take the control picture first. When Lori was attempting to get information about Susie's picture, here's what happens. She starts describing an apartment which she's never been to. She sees a couch. She sees a chair. She sees where Susie sits. She sees a television. She sees artwork on the walls. And she describes, I would say, at least 90% accurately, Susie's apartment, a place she's never been. And remember, Lori is very, quote, psychic. So she's already showing she can do remote viewing.
Mm-hmm.
When we ask her to describe the picture, she has no trouble, meaning she sees a vase, a purple vase, green stems, multiple shapes, and what she describes as, quote, a rainbow of colors. Well, it turns out that there was only one picture that had a vase, a purple vase with a green stem, and a literally all different shapes and sizes of flowers, literally a rainbow of colors, and that was, quote, Susie's picture. Interestingly, she also got other information that was unanticipated. For example, she says that she's shown where Susie lived as a child, and that she's being shown a farmhouse, what looked like a farmhouse to her that was white, and in the backyard there was a garden and a cow. Well, Susie later explained to us she didn't live in a farmhouse, but it was light-colored. But in the backyard, there was a vegetable garden, and there also was a cow. So obviously, Lori was getting information. And, of course, this, you could say, well, this is telepathic. this is remote viewing. So therefore, how do we jump from that to saying maybe the whole thing is telepathy? So now we get to the part of what happens when she's talking to the dead people. Well, when she attempts to talk to the dead people, here's what happens. Lori is overwhelmed with emotion and information from the dead people. For example, when she attempts to contact Linda's father, she receives all kinds of information about how much he loves his daughters and he loves his wife and so on and so forth. And then at some point he says that he wants to tell Linda that he has been seeing his wife, Linda's mother, in her bedroom at night with the shades closed, still crying. Now, this is 7 years now after her father has died. Nobody knows that her mother is still crying with the windows with the drapes closed. So obviously, after the experiment, Linda calls her mother to find out if this was true. Mm-hmm. And her mother confessed that she was still doing this, okay? When Lori is getting this all this personal information, she found it very hard to get information about the pictures. She was so overwhelmed by the personal information
right. And
the dialogue that it was very hard for her to get the pictures. Unlike with Susie, where she got no dialogue, she just got, you know, she just got pictures.
Well, it's this contemporary information that blows me away.
Right, that blows me away too. Anyway, what she does see, and this is crazy, ready for this? She sees a picture of this of Henry holding this green stem with a red large flower. Okay, and she thinks that it might be a rose, but she can't tell. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So it turns out there's only one picture of a single large red flower with a stem. However, it was of a poinsettia, not of a rose.
Okay,
so and that turned out that poinsettia and rose was the red poinsettia was the picture that Susie drew for Henry. However, Linda couldn't believe that her father would pick a poinsettia. So he said, Susie, she said, did my father ask you to draw a poinsettia? Susie said, no. So Linda said, well, what did he ask? And Susie said, well, he asked me to draw a rose, which is what Lori was seeing.
So
Linda said, well, why'd you draw a poinsettia? And she said, well, I explained to your father that I can't draw roses very well. They're hard for me. But I know how to draw poinsettias.
Right.
So he said it was okay. Now, you know, you could take all of this with a grain of salt, or you could say, this is really interesting.
It is really interesting. I'll go for that. Dr. Schwartz, hold on, and we'll be right back to you. Well, if you buy all of this, and you buy the... there really is consciousness that survives death, and I strongly suspect that, then the next thing you have to wonder about is the nature of the other side. I wonder if we know anything. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001. Premier Radio Networks presents Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight's program originally aired February 8th, 2001.
I'm Art Bell with Dr. Gary Schwartz, and we're talking about something pretty important to most of us, whether there's anything after all of this, and what his work would seem to indicate there is. And if there is, then the next logical question, for me anyway, is, what's it going to be like? Are you curious? What's it going to be like? You've got to sort of establish a baseline first, and that's what we've done in terms of trying to prove to you that his research is valid. But after that, you kind of want to know, well, then, you know, what's coming?
Now we take you back to the night of February 8th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
It's just like we do today, only they're going to be very prevalent. That young children are going to be able to not have to discourage this capability, but actually they're going to be able to learn how to do it. Mm-hmm. And not only that, if you're interested, you'll be able to purchase what a friend of ours calls a grandpa phone, like a cell phone, which will enable you to have instantaneous communication, dial up, if you would, to the other side.
Oh, boy.
If not actually have, and this is predicted by the systemic memory hypothesis, actually have technology to visualize the dynamic energy and information of our loved ones right in front of us. Okay? And not only that, you ready for this?
Mm-hmm.
10, 20 years from now, all of this we will take for granted that the distance, that here and there are just two sides of the same coin. That we're all going to take it for granted. And most people would say, I can't imagine that. And what I would say is, the people who can't imagine that are probably the same people who couldn't imagine airplanes 100 years ago.
Yeah, probably Sprint will be offering the other side for 25 cents a minute. Big weekend plan, something, I don't know.
Absolutely. We'll pay for it.
Can you imagine how that would change everything in society if that really came true?
The answer is I can imagine many aspects of it. In fact, in a book that will be that's now in the hands of an editor at a division of Simon & Schuster, a new book will be coming out either the end of this year or the beginning of next year, we have a whole chapter of essentially, you know, why talk to dead people, or what are the implications of all of this? And we lay out the implications for education, for business, for science, for everyday
life. What are some of them, as a matter of fact?
There are tons of them. Let me give you a couple of my favorites right off the top of my head. Let's take marriage.
Okay.
Now, in the old days, there was only one kind of marriage. It was till death did you part. There was no divorce, right? We stayed married. That's what people did. Whether you love your spouse or not, you didn't even pick your spouse. You stayed married. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then what happened is we created a new form of marriage, which is essentially a no-fault divorce, which really means we stay married so long as we're mutually caring for one another.
Right.
So we can be married weeks, months, years, and as if we grow and change, then we have new marriage.
Right.
So we've got two kinds of marriages, really. We've got marriage of indefinite period while we're physically alive, and the kind of till death do us part. And by the way, Linda and I believe that it's silly for us to make these claims in our vows till death do us part if we don't really mean that. Let's just have two different forms. But let's now imagine the possibility that we don't die. We just lose our bodies.
Right.
Now the question is, does marriage end at physical death?
Right.
So what we say is that, well, maybe there are actually three levels of marriage. And the third level of marriage, in the most extreme form, Linda calls them, quote, eternal relationships. That it is possible to meet people and love people and potentially have relationships that would continue far beyond what we can ever even imagine. So you start thinking about relationships in a much deeper way than just the limited time frame on the earth. And it changes literally the whole idea of marriage. And that's just a trivial example, if you would.
So that you could imagine being with your partner forever, or as we think of it, forever,
mm-hmm.
eternally.
That's right.
Yes?
Exactly.
The only catch in that I see is, what about the lost love? Let's say that we have a man and we have a woman,
right.
And their marriage exists for X number of years. And then the man moves on to a young cheerleader.
Mm-hmm.
But the woman remains desperately
eternally in love with that man who's now with the cheerleader.
Right. It causes problems.
Well, here and there, probably.
Exactly. In fact, Linda sees one of the deep implications of having to do therapy between here and there. She calls it soul family therapy. And she sees therapy in the future, literally, taking place between here and there. And not only are you doing therapy for people down here, but you're also literally doing therapy for the people who have died to finish or you know, make amends.
Right.
For conflicts that existed when they were both in the physical, so they can then make choices to move on in their lives or move back together. You see what I'm saying? Because these problems are unavoidable. They're unavoidable. Now, let me give you another deep implication of all of this. What the theory suggests is that the universe is indiscriminating about what kinds of energy and information is retained. In other words, whether you're a good star or a bad star, your starlight continues. Well, the theoretical implication, of course, is whether you have been a deeply loving person or whether you have been a pained, if not horrible, person, your energy and information and consciousness continues.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, just as the Jesus Christs of the world are potentially still here, so are the Hitlers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, people's concern about, quote, negative spirits and the continued dangers of what's happening becomes a very real possibility.
Very real, sure.
Now, let's consider implications for things like, quote, the death penalty.
That's an interesting one.
Sure. I mean, what happens if, quote, the death penalty is not the ultimate punishment? And what happens also if we also use that punishment procedure ineffectually and inaccurately, which, by the way, as you know, is what's happened. Many innocent people have been inadvertently killed, and even when the prosecutors knew that was the case.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, if their souls continue after they've died, the problem hasn't, quote, ended. And not only that, the implications are very deep for the fact that we will not escape what we do on the earth. Which leads us to another whole area about what we talk about into the epilogue in our book, which is called Moving Toward Integrity Love. The choice to be open is ours. And one of the things that we talk about in this book is that if it turns out that there really is survival of consciousness after death, and they can see things that we can't see,
mm-hmm.
two things will happen. Number one, if we lie and cheat on the earth, it's going to come back to haunt us. Because there's not only there's going to be a record of it, but people are actually witnessing it as we're doing it. So we may be getting it away with it down here, but we're going to have to face it later on. Secondly, what happens if you can learn to connect with your deceased loved ones or your, quote, guides? They may be able to inform you about who's lying and cheating to you at the time that they're actually doing it. Well, if we could tell when we're on the earth by getting feedback from there, that we're being deceived, what's going to happen? We're going to ultimately be able to eliminate disintegrity.
I wonder if action could be taken from the other side. That's kind of an interesting question.
Let's make sure we get back to that.
Yeah, we will get back to that. Hold on. We'll break right here and be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. On this side. Maybe that one, too.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8, 2001.
Dr. Dean Adell.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time. Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001.
Good morning, everybody. Don't forget tomorrow night, predictions. That which we didn't get to do between Christmas and the New Year, we're going to do tomorrow night, possibly on into the beginning of Monday as well. So if you would like to register your yearly prediction with the Bell family list, which then is secreted into the Bell family vault, until a year or sometimes even longer passes, tomorrow night will be your opportunity. We'll review some of those done in the past as well. That's all tomorrow night. Back to Dr. Schwartz in a moment.
Coast to Coast AM is happy to announce that our website is now optimized for mobile device users, specifically for the iPhone and Android platforms. Now, you'll be able to connect to most of the offerings of the Coast website on your phone in a quick and streamlined fashion. And if you're a Coast insider, you'll have our great subscriber features right on your phone, including the ability to listen to live programs and stream previous shows. No special app is necessary to enjoy our new mobile site. Simply visit coasttocoastam.com on your iPhone or Android browser. Looking for the truth? You'll find it on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
It's obvious that the things that the Air Force has denied of the UFO phenomenon, there's a plan underfoot not to tell us anything. Why do you think that is?
Look, they've been lying to us, not just on UFOs. They lie about everything. Governments lie about everything. In other words, the moment of disclosure, that's not the end of anything. That is the beginning of an entirely new phase of the struggle for truth.
Now we take you back to the night of February 8th, 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Andrea from San Diego on the Fast Blast asks, is there sex after death? And if not, what kind of lousy death is it?
What a great question. Well, let me just tell you again what people claim. First of all, the theory says everything is possible after death. Okay.
Okay. That covers everything, then.
That, right. That covers pretty much everything. However, what we have heard reports about is literally people continuing to hug and kiss and beyond.
Really?
Even between here and there.
Really?
That's what we have heard.
You mean on the way?
I don't know what's all the way, but after someone's died.
Oh, I see. You said even between here and there. I thought you meant in transit.
No, that I haven't heard. But one
blows the Mile High Club right away.
But seriously, that these are stories that we've heard, and they're from very credible sources. I'll give you an example. There's a woman who we know, this is the part that I find absolutely unbelievable, but it's true. She has both an MD and two PhDs.
Okay.
Very intelligent woman, obviously, and very sophisticated. Her husband died, she's a very open woman, and she started receiving what she believed to be communication from her deceased husband.
Yes.
By the way, he was also a physician.
Yes.
And since she's been open to this, and she's, by the way, gone to mediums and under controlled circumstances and has received information that's confirmed this, at least they're telling her what she herself is experiencing, which is one way to get evidence. She said that what she does with her husband, her parted husband, is not only does she talk to him to get advice and so on in her continued life, but also she will ask him to give her hugs, she will ask him to kiss her, and to remain in physical contact. Now, no, I have not asked her about whether or not she's continued to have sex with her husband. I'm not that bold. But she has said that she literally feels his touch, experiences his interaction, and you could say, well, that's just her fantasy, or maybe she's got a level of connection that most of us don't have.
All right. Well, I'm not going to follow up on that at all. Instead, I'm going to ask you one more.
Sure.
If a person was, let us say, a pathological liar in life, would that follow in death?
Well, the answer, again, what the theory would predict is the way that we've been in the past will be a continued predilection and propensity in the future. Now, the question is, to what extent can we overcome our habits of the past? And the answer is, we should be able to overcome our patterns in the past, just as we can overcome our patterns in the present.
That's right. The theory of growth after...
Exactly. Growth is growth, according to the theory.
I understand. But it may well be that when you arrive there, you're lying your butt off.
Exactly. In fact, one of the things that we therefore propose, one of the deep implications of both the theory and the implications for survival, is that now's the time to become open to it while we're still physically alive. In fact, if we could educate young children that this was true, if it is true, then they could live their lives in a much more open way, so they would not have to die and not even be aware that they're dead, or die and regret the fact that they didn't learn this stuff when they were here.
All right, back to the phones. Wells to the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Hi.
Hi, this is Joy in Honolulu.
Hello.
Oh, it's blessed to have you back, Art.
Thank you.
We have a kind of a great connection from years and years ago. You don't know me, but I know you hail from Chester in Media, and that's where I come from.
Oh, that's right. I lived in Media and was frequently in Chester.
Yeah. Dr. Schwartz, I'm very interested in what you're saying because it's very close to home. As a child, I consistently crossed over, and still do, ever since I was 2 years old. There was a traumatic situation, and my grandmother passed away. And everybody would say, okay, she's not here, but she was always there.
Right.
And even at age 11, when she told me that she had to go, she kind of left the door open, and I was able to pass back and forth. Well, my parents had a lot of conflict with this. And actually, what I have is a comment for you,
mm-hmm.
and then I have a technical question.
Mm-hmm.
My parents had a lot of conflict with it. My mother being Catholic, she wanted me to be a nun, and my father being Baptist,
mm-hmm.
he thought I was full of demons because I would have constant information. And I guess you're aware of the Monroe Institute?
Yes.
But it's the one place where I could actually come to grips and understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And when I attended first program back in 1989, I realized that all of the things that you're saying, he actually put together in programs. And you were saying about what do we do about therapy for people that cross over.
Right.
That's actually addressed in Lifelines. In any case, a lot of different things have occurred to me, and I understand what you're saying because, in actuality, I have constant communication with them, and they help me through daily events, and they help me with decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But as little things go on, I always am saying, well, you know, help me to decide on where I should go in the life and what I should be doing. And ironically, I'm in radiology in the field of MRI, and different radiologic fields.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wanting to know, I've noticed something technically that when I am actually in an MRI unit,
mm-hmm.
and you were talking about array system and phased and unphased and things like that,
mm-hmm.
well, my group brought that subject to me long before I ever got into the mechanics of MRI.
Right.
And I started thinking, well, what do they mean about phased array and unphased array? And then, of course, when I got to studying MRI, I recognized that it had a lot to do with the magnetic forces.
Oh.
Well, when I was in there with quite a few patients, I recognized that I could see other beings. Of course, you don't go around to your other tech saying, oh, guess what, I see other people
in
there.
No, I wouldn't do that, but this is really interesting. Do you realize the size of the electromagnetic field around an MRI machine?
Yeah, it's a...
I had an MRI, and the technician said, you want to see something? And he opened up the front of it, and he took a steel bar, and he turned on the machine and put the steel bar up against the electromagnet and said, try and pull it off. No way.
Right.
The size of the electromagnetic field is monstrous.
So right. Are you sharing with
1.5 in a single in one Tesla field, you know, and you're working with 42.58 megahertz that go along with the hydrogen.
I understand.
Yeah, so it's really fascinating.
Wait, are you suggesting that you actually are able to see better in the presence of an MRI?
Exactly.
Oh,
that's
wow.
what I'm trying to say.
Oh my God! Listen. I don't usually say this, okay? But we are holding this conference called Celebrating the Living Soul and Living in the Universe, March 8th through 10th,
mm-hmm.
okay, at the university. It's the first time ever. And we're going to be talking about all the science and survival of consciousness after death. We're going to be talking about our research in the Human Energy Systems Laboratory. We're going to have a medium present. You can find out about it at the website, livingenergyuniverse.com. If there's any way that you could potentially attend this workshop, we would love it, because we're deeply interested in the very phenomena that you are reporting. And I would love our audience to hear about this and also to show you what we're doing in the laboratory. Because we've been recording 12 gigahertz signals coming off the body and finding that the body actually generates very high frequency signals.
Yeah, and I can really truthfully say if anything was really helpful is the instruction that I got at Monroe Institute, because it allowed me to sequence things, and I actually got into MRI after that whole situation.
No, I understand. But if you can possibly get there, man, please do. That's absolutely remarkable.
I will not forget this.
That's really remarkable and not so surprising as
no,
I think about it.
No, it's not. Is your caller still here?
No, she's gone now.
She's gone now. Can I just share with you one observation?
Yes, of course.
This is a very interesting claim. It's been reported in a book written by a very distinguished professor from Stanford on human energy systems. And it's the following claim, that when mediums are placed in what's called a Faraday cage, that's a cage that filters...
everything out, no, any electromagnetic energy.
No, it only filters out the electrical but not the magnetic. Filters out the electrical, but not the magnetic.
Well, electromagnetic energy, for example, in the form of a radio wave would be filtered out.
Yeah, the electrical part, but not the magnetic part. Let me repeat this. Let me tell you the story, Art. This is very important.
Yeah, go ahead.
You do not lose the magnetic fields. For example, if you put a compass in the room, a compass will still point north because it still picks up the Earth's magnetic field, even though the electrical wave has been eliminated. Under those circumstances, the average medium picks up information better. It's as if the radio waves are, the electrical waves are distracting. Now you put people in what's called a mu shielded room. A mu shielded room is where you have a shield that shields the magnetic signals, which is not what's happening with MRI. MRI is actually integrating the signals, or synchronizing them. When you eliminate the magnetic signals, under those circumstances, the average medium is less able to pick up communication from the deceased, implying that the communication is magnetic.
In nature, sure.
In nature.
Not a surprise.
Now, why I'm sharing that is because that clicks with what your last caller said.
Sure.
That in the presence of an MRI that is producing a phase synchronization, which she says that she's received from the other side, then under those circumstances, she has greater experience. And that's, to me, a very important, you know, observation that needs to be followed up.
Well, I hope she goes to the conference or gets in contact with you, because that should be followed up on.
Without doubt.
You know, while we're at it, since we're talking to so many people, I wonder if anybody else out there that works with MRI all the time has had any experiences they would like to relate.
Great. Or any other electromagnetic signals that relate to all of this.
Yeah, but MRI in particular, because it's just it's almost a strong enough field to distort things about it. I mean, it's really gigantic.
That's right. That's
really interesting. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, this is John from Los Angeles.
Hi, John.
Hi, John.
Glad to have you back, Art.
Thank you.
First time caller. I am an example of a multiple medium sitter. My wife and soulmate, who I consider my twin soul, which is another show, I think, passed away from cancer in January of 2000, and we were very, very tight and already very open and well studied in spiritualism and past lives and reincarnations and things like that. So we had a lot of time to prepare for it, and we made various agreements and pacts about attempted communications afterwards.
Oh, really?
So that's the setup to this, right?
Okay.
So when she passed, from then until now, the amount of ADCs, as they call them, after-death communications that I've been receiving are so prolific that it's almost like a normal way of life for me.
Really?
I just call them interdimensional communications, and I now have an interdimensional relationship.
Wow.
So I'm writing a book on this, and that's another story. But
wow, okay.
To corroborate this for my book, and I had never before been to a medium.
Right.
But one night I was surfing the web for other things. I'm a jazz musician, and I was doing other things. And all
of
a sudden, I was on the Amazon.com looking up some books, and somehow there was an advertisement there for a very famous medium whose name is George Anderson.
Right.
He's one of the well-tested ones.
Sure.
And I've not seen George because he's very busy, but when the book flashed on the page, I got this communication from my wife like, you should go see one of those because that will handle your own self-doubt. This
right.
is a telepathic communication. So then I started doing research on lots of mediums.
Mm-hmm.
And now, within the last 5 to 6 months, I've seen 6 different ones
wow.
who have corroborated almost literally every detail, and none of them know me, none of them knew each other,
oh,
and it was during the 6 month period. And the things
wow.
that have happened were so amazing that I'm just flabbergasted at this, because to me this is firsthand proof, and I cannot explain it in any other way other than, you know, that one caller that said, how do you know it's an imposter?
Sure.
I mean, okay, that's about the only thing, and even then, I know my wife.
Right.
And so, boy, if this is an imposter, this imposter is following my life and monitoring it, because she is so accurate, it's amazing.
All right, appreciate
the call. Before you go away, by the way, could I just make a request?
Sure.
And that is, please go to the website. You'll find our phone number and email and so on. And if you're interested, please contact us, because we
what,
have been
through the website number?
The website is www.livingenergyuniverse. That's one word, livingenergyuniverse.com. We are always searching for people who are like yourself, have had these kinds of experiences, and are then also validating them. So you're, as you said, you're both a medium and a sitter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's and you're also doing this scientifically. By the way, I was also a jazz musician.
Oh,
so I appreciate music.
And, I still am.
I feel blessed to be on this whole program and have for Art to have invited me on this. But for your comment, for example, to come through right now, it's very important that your book get written. It's very important that it be. That we can, and one of the things that's very interesting about our research is that we can provide scientific validation under
exactly.
even double-blind conditions.
That's why I did all these multiple sittings, because I now after 5 of them, it's just too, it's, you know, the probability is getting astronomical.
Have you taken detailed notes on this? Have you kept records?
I'm taping them all and
wonderful.
Corroborating all the data and researching and aligning all the ones that are working, and it's I'm flabbergasted. As a matter of fact, I'm even flabbergasted that I'm on the phone, because I've never called Art and even attempted, and today I just had my last medium sitting, which was mind-blowing. I knew I'd never go to sleep tonight because it was so unbelievable. And then on the way back from my recording studio, I turned Art shows on, and then what is absolutely on but you talking about this? That's just too synchronous.
Isn't the universe wonderful?
It is synchronicity. All right, thank you very much. Doctor, let me ask you this.
Sure.
Of, you know, there are people like this gentleman, like the lady with the MRI,
mm-hmm.
People having these experiences. She said, I wouldn't even begin to tell another technician about any of this. I wouldn't
right.
even speak about it.
Right.
How many people, mediums, professional mediums, and just people who can do the things these people are talking about, would, do you think, step out, step forward, and subject themselves to scientific scrutiny in trying to figure out what it is they're really doing?
Well, obviously this is an extreme minority, but I think that there's a tremendous transformation that's taking place, and that for example, let me give you an example of it. There's another gentleman, of all places, in Los Angeles, who had a very similar experience. It wasn't his wife, it was a dear male friend. He's a psychiatric social worker. His name is George Dalzell, and he also has a website. And he began to have mediumistic experiences, and he went to mediums, and it was corroborated, and he's written the book, which, by the way, Linda and I have written a foreword for, which provides evidential information, and he's now participated in our research. And I find it very, quote, coincidental that within just a few months, there are now 2 people from Los Angeles who seem to have these kinds of very unique experiences. What I can share is, and it's been my experience, is that shows like yours, and yours in particular, and when as people hear about our research, they start feeling more comfortable about sharing their experience.
Of course that would be true. Sure, as we expose it. Hold on, we're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Oh, I don't know.
You're listening to Art Bell, Somewhere in Time, Tonight featuring a replay of Coast to Coast AM from February 8th, 2001. Somewhere in Time on Premier Radio Networks. Tonight, an encore presentation of Coast to Coast AM from February 8, 2001.
Maybe we will survive. I don't know. I hope so. I hope there's something else, and I'm sure most of you do too. And that's what we're talking about with Dr. Schwartz. We'll get right back to you.
Now we take you back to the night of February 8th. 2001, on Art Bell, Somewhere in Time.
Doctor, welcome back.
Thank you.
Got a full line of people who would like to ask you a question. It's been a very interesting time with the callers, hasn't it?
It's been wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Just by the way, before we begin, you know, one of the thoughts that occurred to me is that you've never done a show where we've talked about the whole energy systems approach and all the science about measuring electromagnetic signals from the body and all of its implications.
No,
for healing and the lack.
Right?
And if you'd like to do that, focusing on those kinds of things rather than these topics, I mean, it would be very nice to continue the conversation.
By all means, yes, indeed. All right, here we go. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Hi.
Hi, this is Ed in Honolulu.
Hello, Ed.
Hi, Ed. Great show tonight.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Mr. Bell and Dr. Schwartz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, earlier today, you were talking about how Einstein was imagining himself to be a... imagining himself as a beam of light,
mm-hmm.
and that you imagined yourself to be in a feedback loop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was trying to imagine what it would be like for myself to be a spirit on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking, well, would I be able to both see the past, present, and future?
Mm-hmm.
And if I were able to do that, then could I not also observe myself in the present from the other side? And that if I were able to do that, then that might give some insight into how we actually look at our existence, that we actually exist on the other side all the time, and we exist only on this side temporarily, and that during the out-of-body experience, like if I have a near-death experience, what really happens is that when my body dies, what's left is the part that's always there on the spirit side observing myself.
Mm.
And that when I actually return to my body, I don't actually follow through on the complete death, then my consciousness is no longer aware of myself on the other side, but again, the consciousness becomes prevalent on this side. And I wanted to know what you thought of that.
Wow. Well, let me so first of all tell you that it's extremely creative. Okay? I've not heard anything like that before. Secondly, I have to comment to you and to Art that this has been a most illuminating show. Your audience are asking absolutely wonderful questions.
Yes, they really are.
Third, I think that what you say is also conceptually plausible. And the implications to me are just, I'm sitting here sort of trying to catch my breath, because I think that you may be right. I'd encourage you, by the way, to continue to take this, quote, imaginary trip and to write some notes about it, because I think you may have stumbled on something that's very meaningful. I, by the way, myself try to imagine what it's like to be a deceased spirit, but I've always sort of imagined myself as an observer of others, as opposed to looking back at myself, which is what you've proposed.
Yeah.
And I think it's a very, I'm fascinated.
You know, you mentioned also heaven and hell.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking hell might be, and it kind of relates to karma, hell might be having to observe myself.
It might be, actually, somebody sent, thank you, a message of, a fast blast message about hell, and said, you know, if there was open communications with our sprint 25 cents a minute or whatever,
right,
to the other side, who would want to hear about all the negatives of hell?
That's right.
I would. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would. If somebody were to describe to me the hell they were living in, or existing in, or eternally spending time in, I would very much like to hear that. I'd like to know, wouldn't you?
Yes, but you're a very open-minded person, Art. And you have a very inquisitive mind.
Perhaps. Perhaps too inquisitive. First time caller line, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Hi.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, this is Emily in California.
Okay.
And, well, I have two things that sort of relate to each other. I kind of wanted to ask about it. I 5 years ago, I had a child. And when I gave birth to her, I started to lose a lot of blood. And they had to rush doctors in, and I was dying. I was losing a lot of blood. And what I did was I felt myself, like, dissipating and rising up. And I was very indifferent about the situation. You think that you'd be scared or something like that, but I was really indifferent about it, but I was... Before I felt that way, I checked. I said, I don't remember saying this, but the people in the room said that I said, I'm filling up the room. Like, I felt myself just, like, expanding. And I checked and looked at my daughter, and she was in my mother's arms, and that's what I had to do before I felt like I could take off and go where I had to go. I had to check that everything was the way it was supposed to be. And then they saved me, obviously. And since then, it seems like there's things that have happened in my life that have just put me in these positions that I wouldn't normally be in to take some physics courses and learn about the nature of the universe. And in this physics course I took, the only waves that we really didn't focus on were sound waves, because they were so different than the photons or the energy from light. And something just keeps pressing in my mind that the sound has something to do with that, like, we're missing, that sound waves have to do are the key. And also I'll find myself I was jogging out in the trails, and I went a wrong way, and I got completely lost, and it was getting darker, and I really didn't know where I was. And I stopped and sort of started to panic, and I turned and went this other way, and then I stopped again, and then a voice told me, trust yourself, you're going the right way. But it was talking to me, it was this really kind, caring voice said, trust yourself, little one, you're on the right path. And before I knew it, I was I was in the right place. And then just today, I ran into somebody in a hallway who was working on computers. And I just, all of a sudden, I just asked him, you know, do you think that all the computing the more we enter like a ubiquitous era of computing, do you think it's going to change our frequencies, all this electric magnetic field? Do you think it's going to change our frequencies to how we conceive things mentally? And I was just wondering if there was something that I just feel myself like increasingly approaching the ability to just break through seeing all kinds of things, and I was wondering if there was something I could do to fine-tune that.
Enhance that, all right? Doctor?
Well, a prior caller mentioned what's called the Monroe Institute.
Yes.
And they have a formal training program.
Well, I'm well aware. I interviewed Robert Monroe before he passed on.
Did you really?
Yes.
Okay, well, I know, Linda and I know a person by the name of Bruce Mowens very well, and Bruce Mowens has a website. He's also written at least 3 books on traveling to the afterlife. He's an engineer by training, scientifically oriented, and he's very interested in helping people develop their capacity to relate to the kinds of things that your caller is relating to. And I would say that that's certainly one avenue to pursue.
All right. Very good. Wildcard Line, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Good morning.
Good morning, Art.
Hi.
This is Joy. I'm in Santa Cruz. I'm listening to you over at the Internet.
Okay.
And first of all, I want to say this is an incredibly beautiful show.
Thank you.
And so good to have you back. Anyway, I have a question for Dr. Schwartz. You've been talking about the concept of everything being conscious
mm-hmm.
at one level of it or the other, right?
Right.
Now, I have been, in my own life, following the path that the planet herself is a conscious being, and that we are all part of her consciousness.
Okay.
And that when we start to coalesce in consciousness, when we start to realize that we're all part of this consciousness,
mm-hmm.
that it can kind of kickstart us into a better place of being. And this is also something related a lot to what you have said, Art, in that part of the quickening is also part of the consciousness expanding.
Yes.
And what I would like to find out is if Gary has actually thought about how to kickstart all of us into a more heightened consciousness within ourselves. I mean, I look at it from ourselves to our bodies, the ecosystems in our around us, to the very planet herself
mm-hmm.
in terms of opening ourselves to consciousness expansion. And we're all part of this overall evolution.
Right. I believe that, and I believe that's how I can feel the things I do about what's happening out there. And I think I'm not unusual in that. I think any fairly sensitive person can.
Mm-hmm. Well, Art, you have been a really incredible person in trying to take that message up. I was just wondering what Gary thought about it, too.
Sure.
Okay.
Well, in the epilogue to our book, which is called Moving Toward Integrity Love, The Choice to be Open is Ours. And I think the key phrase in all of this is being open. Yogi Berra, who's a sort of a great philosopher, has this wonderful phrase. He says, if I hadn't believed it, I wouldn't have seen it. Which is, of course, the backwards in the way we typically
sure.
taught it. But I think that that's profoundly important. I mean, in the case of science, for example, if you don't believe in something is possible, you won't try it, or you won't find it in the data. You
mm-hmm.
have to be willing to discover it. Now, what happens if we take this to its logical extreme and say that we're, so to speak, blinded by what we've been taught? It's very much constrained us. And if we could entertain thoughts that would open us, it could be that the breakthrough is absolutely, quote, natural.
Yes.
It's a really natural process.
Yes, I agree with that.
And what we need to do, in part, is to reinforce each other. Now, again, being the, quote, hard-headed scientist part,
what Linda and I are proposing in this this conference that's coming up is what we call evidence-based spirituality. That it's not science versus spirituality. It's science in the service of spirituality.
Right. Right. Exactly right. All right. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Good morning.
Good morning, Art. Good morning, Dr. Schwartz.
Hi.
My name's Brian. I'm in St. Louis, and I'm a first-time caller.
All right.
And my question is regarding the idea of continuing consciousness and people who claim to have half-life regression experiences. How does that fit in? I mean, is life an internal cycle where you go through like periods of out-of-body and in-the-body, you know, continuing life, or how do you feel?
Okay, well, let me say, first of all, what the theory predicts. First of all, the theory absolutely requires the possibility of reincarnation. It absolutely requires it because the energy and information is there, and therefore it can return. However, the theory also makes some revisions or suggestions for alternative ways to think about reincarnation. And here's what you know is typically taught, that what happens is our energy and information is somehow returned to a new body as if all of it is put in there. However, what physics tells us is that our energy and information is constantly expanding into space, and it's virtually impossible to gather all of that and squeeze it back in. So it may be the case that it's not an either-or, but it may be an and. It may be the case that we can, quote, seed and return like eggs and sperms, so to speak, but that still we can also maintain our original integral consciousness in a continuing form. In other words, it may not be either-or, but it may be and. Now, let me give you a second interesting complication of the theory.
Okay.
When we do past-life regressions, for example, and people have experiences, and they have, quote, memories, and they feel very strong, the question is, and I consider this really a very interesting question, is how do we know when we have such an experience whether that memory is really, quote, our memory, or what we're doing is we're just deeply resonating with somebody else's memory?
That was going to be the next question.
Right. And let me tell you, the answer to that question is, I don't have an answer to that question.
Right.
Right now, I have to make that discrimination. And I think it's, again, one of those great questions that we have to look to the future.
Well, the reason I was coming to this was I had heard someone once before, I believe, on Coast to Coast AM last summer when Art wasn't there, say something to the effect of that they believed that people were born sometimes memories from the prior life,
mm-hmm.
and that they would have dreams about this, and then that's when they would get into past regression, past life
sure.
regression. And the reason that this kind of touched a chord with me was that I remember when I was very, very young having these just strange nightmares where I was repeatedly, very vividly watching myself from the point of view of an older man falling to my death.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, the idea that, gee, is that just some kind of leftover memory from a prior life?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're saying is it could be a resonance from someone else. That makes sense. I was just, that's what keyed this question.
I hear what you're saying. I mean, I don't have an answer to your question. I guess
right.
what I prefer to do is just adding more complication to your question.
Right, but you're giving some good ideas.
Okay.
Right, it goes central to the whole question about your research. It's just like that giant question about your research, that final question, isn't it?
Absolutely. By the way, just although you haven't mentioned it, I know in your program that you sometimes talk about what are called, quote, UFOs.
Sure.
And one of the things that's really been novel that's emerged lately, in fact, it may have come on when your former host raised the question,
mm-hmm.
was the question about, well, how, is it possible to reinterpret what we experience as UFOs? And one of the ideas that has come to Linda and I is the possibility about what happens if there are deceased individuals from other planets. The advantage of being, quote, deceased is that physicality is no longer a constraint. It's much easier to travel across the universe and carry with you all your knowledge and information if you're not in a physical body than if you are in a physical body.
But it would be, the communication would be so far out of our frame of reference that we would regard that probably with our life experience as some sort of evil entity.
That's right. But what would happen if what we're actually witnessing is the re-physicalization of previously, quote, deceased individuals? So they're not, quote, traveling across in spaceships.
Oh, my.
You know?
One more. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with Dr. Schwartz. Hello.
Good morning, Art.
Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor. My name's Leonard, and I'm calling from Ina and Thorny, the LA area.
Okay.
Doctor, you had answered part of my question about the UFOs. But how about cross species to, say, our animals or pets and things?
Oh, boy, that's a wonderful, wonderful
question. It sure is.
We are deeply interested in the question of, quote, pets and pet souls. And in our research, by the way, we've repeatedly found that mediums very accurately get information about deceased animals. That's number one. Number two, deceased animals seem to really hang around with their departed, with their living loved ones. They seem to be loyal in death like they have been in life. Thirdly, mediums are very good at often discriminating, you know, types of breeds and types of animals and so on. And then, of course, the fourth thing is that what happens if you've got animals from other generations or even from other planets? And it all becomes extremely interesting. There's a veterinarian, by the way, in Connecticut who has developed a deep interest in actually looking at the deceased animal relationships with other deceased animals as well as people who are living.
Wow.
And we think it's also one of those great areas for the future.
It's really reaching to other animals. That's really reaching.
What can you do? I mean, you just got to follow the logic where it takes you.
If the center of your theory is true, then it's absolutely logical. But it's pretty wild just to consider.
Oh, no, it was terribly wild.
Well, it sure has been fun having you on the program. And, it's a lot of food for thought. And I've thought a lot about this, believe me. And it shows right here at my waist. Doctor, it's been great. We'll have you on again. You want to give out your website one more time? Although
sure.
We've got it linked, folks. If you go to www.artbell.com, it's right there. But, Doctor, go ahead.
Sure. It's www.livingenergyuniverse.com. And we look forward to hearing from people because that's what it's all about. It's sharing and teaching each other.
All right, my friend. Have a good night, and thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Take care. Some really, really interesting calls. I really liked the MRI call, and that one's going to keep me thinking for a while as well. All right, tomorrow night, open lines all the way. We're going to do predictions and review the predictions, at least as many as I can, of last year, or this year, previous year, actually. Good night.